Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Fluently Forward. For today's episode, just a little note up top. I have been traveling for the past couple of weeks. I was over in LA. I went on the Juicy Scoop podcast. I went to a podcast conference. It was podcast everywhere, which, by the way, I got so much good gossip in LA. Every single person I talked to, my Uber driver knew two girls who Diddy had paid off. The valet, like every single person I talked to had a celebrity story. So I wrote them all down and put it into an hour-long episode over on Patreon if you want to check any of that out. But because of the traveling, today's episode is going to be the mini episode, and then Wednesday is going to be the actual typical Fluently Forward episode that you are used to. It's going to be a deep dive into Dune. Oh my God, the blind items, the rumors, the gossip on set. Why was Austin Butler so attractive as a bald psychopath? I mean, honestly, but even if you haven't seen Dune or Dune 2, Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, it's going to get all into it. But for today, I am interviewing Amanda Montell from the Sounds Like a Cult podcast. And this was really exciting because ever since I started Fluently Forward, so many people have said, I listen to Sounds Like a Cult. You have to listen to them. All of your episodes, like you guys talk about the same topics. So I was very excited when Amanda reached out to me and sent me over her new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, because it covers a ton of topics that Fluently Forward covers. So you guys were completely on the money. So without further ado, my interview with Amanda is here, and then I will see you guys on Wednesday for a full episode of Fluently Forward. Bye, guys. Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Fluently Forward. I am so excited to have on a wonderful guest to talk about all things The Age of Magical Overthinking, Amanda Montell from the Sounds Like a Cult podcast. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I am okay. I'm actually doing pretty good today. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to talk with you about this because every single chapter of what you talk about in this book, and so many people, ever since I started the podcast, they were like, you have to collab with Sounds Like a Cult. Like everything you talk about is everything up their alley, et cetera, et cetera. So Before we get into all of the questions I have for you, can you tell everyone a little bit about this new book of yours, The Age of Magical Overthinking?
Of course. So The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality is the subtitle. It's about cognitive biases in the information age. So it's about digital age Delulu, if you will, where every chapter is dedicated to a different cognitive bias. So a psychological shortcut that we unconsciously take to make efficient decisions, this kind of mental magic trick that we play on ourselves. And I use each of those biases as a lens to explore some mysterious irrationality from the larger zeitgeist and my own life. So the book explores topics from celebrity worship to nostalgia to our obsession with Instagram manifestation gurus. It was a very fun and cathartic and healing and informative book to write.
You talk about Taylor Swift and stan culture, and you must have been so excited too that by the time this book comes out, like, she's just getting bigger and bigger and the stans are getting more and more stanier. I'm so fascinated by the culture of stans, right? Obviously Fluently Forward, we talk about celebrities, and I always find it so funny that whenever I do a certain episode on a celebrity, I'll get a bunch of like death threats in my DMs, but it's it's all tiny versions of the celebrity space because it's all from stans. So I'll be like, Selena Gomez, I remember I said a TikTok video, I was like, I just don't think she can sing live that well, right?
That's not a hot take.
But like her tiny face is like Selena Gomez being like, go kill yourself. But like the eye is always an exclamation mark. And I'm always fascinated by this devotion of people to ride for someone they've never met, to kill for someone they've never met. And it's really fascinating. So my first question to you is, which celebrity did you find with the craziest stan group? Like, you referenced Taylor Swift. I know everybody talks about the Beehive with Beyonce, the BTS Army. Who do you think is the most kind of fanatical?
Oh gosh. Well, admittedly, I did not do a comprehensive survey of every single stan community. So I have a select few to choose from. But from my research, I would honestly say Charlie XCX. I write about her standom a little bit in the book, but they're interesting. I mean, some of the strangest behaviors, some of the strangest, most brutal and most devoted juxtapositions of behaviors that I've seen have emerged in that fan community. For example, There are fans who've brought like vials of their dead mother's ashes to her meet and greets for her to sign. They've asked her to sign poppers, like the drug. So a lot of like really bizarre dehumanizing behavior. And that's the thing that I really wanted to communicate in that chapter is that we are expecting celebrities to swerve way outside of their lane as entertainers to fulfill almost a spiritual authority role in our lives, a political authority role in our lives. And that really stems from a lot of the mistrust that we now have in institutions like the government and the healthcare system and traditional religion, which is fair enough. But we're really putting these like larger than life role model expectations on celebrities due to a cognitive bias called the halo effect. That's the kind of theme of that chapter. And it really explains a lot because it describes our tendency to admire one quality in a person and then jump to the conclusion that they're perfect overall. And it stems from the ways that we used to find role models in the hunter-gatherer period for survival purposes. So if you were living in a small community and you saw someone with big muscles, it was fair enough to jump to the conclusion that they must also be a good hunter, a good fighter, a good survivor. And so you would want to align with them for your own survival purposes. And that was reasonable enough. But now we're mapping those conclusion jumping strategies onto parasocial role models in the modern world. And that's proving extremely deleterious for both the idol and the fans because that's not an in-person relationship that you can mend. It's subject to extreme lionization, worship, and dethronement when that celebrity might do something to disappoint you, even if that something is as innocuous as putting out a single that you don't like. And so that's the dehumanization of the worship and dethronement that I was interested in exploring in that chapter. And I've noticed those dynamics emerge in a really peculiar way in the Charli XCX fandom, where people will lionize her as mother and then lambast her for her tragic flops in the space of one tweet.
And it's always the creep. Oh my God, I hate when they go, obviously mother is one thing. And then also instead of giving somebody albums and songs, it's like you're feeding us. So then it's like, mother, you're feeding us. And it's like so weirdly fucking biological. It's like, oh my God, like you're nursing at like the celebrity's breast. But what you
Sweet.
talked about, with that halo effect was so interesting. And like you take one characteristic of somebody and you just assume others. I remember back in the day when Susan Boyle could sing, everybody was like, but she's ugly, so it doesn't make any sense. Like people literally ascribe one characteristic for another. I even
That's
saw it
right.
too, like when King Charles had his cancer diagnosis can't come out, there were so many people kind of similar to the billionaires and the submersible who were like, good riddance, I hope he dies, like the monarchy sucks. But then pretty Kate Middleton has cancer and everybody's like, you can't say a single fucking thing about it, how dare you, this is a mother who might be feeding us. And it's just like crazy the different attributes we ascribe to people.
Completely. It really boils down to the fact that we don't make decisions rationally as a species. How could we? We have limited time, we have limited memory storage, we have limited cognitive resources. We just make decisions that are good enough, considering all those conditions. The issue is that these cognitive biases that once helped us make good enough decisions are now sort of obsolete because our society has become so much more complex and abstract and disembodied. And so these once really useful cognitive biases are disservicing us in a way that we're not even privy to because we're so used to them and we apply them unconsciously. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like the halo effect affects, well, it affects women differently than men. I will say that. Women have simply a slimmer margin of error in our society. And I titled that chapter, "Are You My Mother, Taylor Swift?" Because I couldn't help but notice while researching the halo effect that the ways that stans of Taylor Swift or Beyoncé or any of these female pop stars in particular react so brutally to their mothers, their surrogate pop star mothers, when they do something to betray them or that they perceive as a betrayal. Those dynamics reminded me so much of my behavior as an adolescent when I was realizing for the first time that my own mom, my real life mom, was just a human and that she was fallible and that she wasn't perfect. And I would punish her pretty gravely for that. You know, whenever my mom did something that I felt like violated this perfect image that I had of her in my mind, which was natural. You know, a lot of kids perceive their parents as infallible. Whenever she would do something that would contradict that, I would yell at her, you know, like conflict emerged. And fortunately, like in those in-person dynamics, and this is true across the board, those are relationships that can oftentimes be mended with empathy, with the social glue of having in-person interactions. But those relationships can't be mended when they're parasocial. We long for role models. We long for mother figures, especially when we're feeling extremely isolated. And I think, you know, life is becoming increasingly isolated and disembodied. And I came across some really fascinating research for that chapter that suggested that young people who are lacking in positive stressors in their real life from their real parental community or their real parental figures and communities are more likely to fixate on what was termed trauma in the virtual world. So they will engage in these conflicts that are not even real online because they don't have practice building resilience in response to conflicts in real life. And there was some pretty fascinating research that connected parental absence with a likelihood to obsess or even worship celebrities in a way that was really detrimental to mental health. And I was just like fascinated by those dynamics, especially in the context of today's society, where we just kind of take it for granted now that pop stars are meant to be these political, spiritual, personal role models, when that is a fairly new development that kind of stems from the Reagan era, you know, our first celebrity president. Before then, we just perceived pop stars as entertainers and nothing more. But it says something about our culture at large that we expect more from them.
Oh my God, yeah, we expect them to do everything. I find it so crazy that it's like the upcoming presidential election and you're looking for advice from someone who grew up as a Disney child star getting 2 hours of school in a trailer. Like what the fuck do they know that you don't know? And people just kind of behoove all of these experts for whoever's shinier on Instagram or also
Yes.
shows you the inside of their fridge or something like that. And it's just it's really wild to me too. And you brought up the great point too that not only are you taking these celebrities, or I feel like you could do content creators, right? I think artists, I feel like singers usually get the brunt of it because, unlike an actor who, if they're in a bad movie, it's like, well, the script wasn't their fault. Like the directing wasn't their fault. With the singer, you're like, you sang it. It was your lyrics. It was your life. Like you did the bad visuals for the
That's a
album.
good point.
So I
Yeah.
think they usually get the brunt of it the most. But not only are you putting them on this like incredibly high pedestal and like expecting all of these things, but then you get so mad when they don't do it. And it really is like parasocial isn't even the word for it. And I feel bad for them because as a content creator, as someone who needs people to be streaming your next single, you want to court the audience who's online. But the people who are making your fan tumblers are also probably like, let's be honest, like the most unhinged type of person who's going to turn on you for a second. So like you actually want to be courting the people who are like going on daily walks and like getting vitamin D.
Yeah, I definitely notice a difference in interactional style between like my most hardcore podcast listeners and my book readers. And that's like purely due to the medium itself. Like when you're reading something, it causes you to slow down a little bit and to like engage your critical thinking skills a little bit more. But if you're listening to a podcast, it's going down so quickly, so smoothly. You're maybe not paying quite as much of attention or as close of attention. And also, like, you're hearing my voice for so many weeks in a row for so many hours, and you start to feel like you know that person. And by the way, like, I have engaged in these deleterious parasocial dynamics as well. Like, there are authors and public figures who I have built up in my head as perfect. And you mentioned the word shiny earlier, and that's like the perfect way to describe it, because if you imagine the analogy of a halo, the terminology behind the halo effect, you picture like a Renaissance painting, a crown of light above an angel, and that's bathing them in this heavenly luster. But importantly, it's also darkening everything else around them. So you can no longer see that person in the context of their humanity and in the context of their life. You're only seeing them online in this overly perfect context. And the halo effect is at play. So if you like their work or if you like their podcast or if there's one thing about them that you identify with or admire, you are more prone than ever to elevate them onto this pedestal. And I myself have done this where, you know, I liked a writer's writing and then I followed them on I followed them on Instagram, and let's say they posted something that I felt like violated my expectations of who they were. That was based on nothing but my own delusion. And then I felt the need to feel mad at them. Like, and that's like so Delulu. And becoming, you know, familiar with the halo effect has really helped me mitigate those feelings in myself. But I don't know if you've noticed this either, like on your own account, hopefully not, or on, you know, other public figures accounts, where someone will feel betrayed by you in this parasocial way because of something you posted that, I don't know, just like sat wrong with them or defied their expectations of you. And that causes them to go through a one-sided breakup of sorts. And so they will comment something like, so disappointed in this take, unfollowing. And then I found that there's now this trend where other people will clamor to that person's comment and say things like, this isn't an airport. You don't need to announce your departure. And I find that that's so funny, because what that whole interaction is representing is that, like, when we feel disappointed by these celebrities or public figures, micro celebrities, whoever they are, that we've uplifted onto this pedestal, we can't just unfollow. That feels so anticlimactic. Like, that's not how a breakup is supposed to go. A breakup is supposed to be explosive. It's supposed to be two-sided. So we feel the need to comment, or else like we're truly just like disappearing into the night, and that doesn't feel satisfying. But at the same time, it is a little Delulu, and that's where all these other comments will flood in, like, this isn't an airport, you don't need to announce your departure. I think like another way of putting that is like, this isn't a breakup, like, you don't need to throw a fit, like, it feels like one because you've grown attached in this one-sided way. So these are just fascinating dynamics that I've been enjoying exploring from a behavioral economics standpoint.
Oh my God, I've never related to something more. And I think something else you experience as a podcaster is I have panicky, clench my insides of my cheek nightmares almost every night that like I said the wrong thing. I had a nightmare the other night that I went on Instagram and I posted a Q&A and I said, what's your favorite slur? And I had, and even in my dream, I'm like, why would I do this? Why am I, what happened? Like, why would I post that? But you're so nervous about like, all the moments you've put your foot in your mouth or offended someone without saying it. I'll never forget. This was so funny, but like, over on Patreon, I made a joke about how like people who collect rocks are losers, which by the way, I always call myself a loser. I'm like, I play The Sims for hours. I like to, you know, watch TV with my hand in my pants, just resting on my pubes. Just like, loser behavior is like the best thing to me. So I always say that with love. The way I got probably about 70 messages from people who collect rocks being like, this made me upset, like, I collect rocks, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, oh my, who would have thought, like, who would have thought that all of these people were disappointed in me? And I saw on Instagram that you also follow Africa Brooke. She's like my number one follow for people. And she talks all about this, you know, the act of like trying not to self-censor yourself. And she had an entire post about the word disappointed and how strange it is for, it's just like weird for a stranger that you've never met to be like, I'm disappointed in you. And it's almost guilty and shamey, or this idea of like, I agreed with the last 13,000 things you said, but this one thing we don't rely on. So here's why I'm disappointed. And I always find that wild. So my question to you is, what content space do you think breeds that most parasocial? Like, is it a YouTube vlogger? Is it a podcaster? Is it a TikTok streamer?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, I am totally biased because as a podcaster, like I want to say that that is the medium that fosters the most intense parasocial dynamics because of the sheer volume of conversation, intimate, seemingly personal conversation that folks are tuning into week after week after week. But that's probably true of Twitch streaming as well. It's also probably true of YouTubers. I would say like the short form content, not as much, because the algorithm is serving you that in a different way. You won't see every single last thing that person posts. And the short form content, I think, is so geared toward virality. It's not as much geared toward a slow burn of cultivating relationships. I mean, my last book was about cults. And I mean, I've had the most meta experiences talking on my podcast about cultishness in everyday life and really clocking the strategies.
Oh, because then the fans of the cult, or like the cult members, probably listen, which is like your version of celebrity stans. And it's like,
yes. And the interesting thing about podcasting too, I mean, I could talk about this for an hour, is that The medium allows so many different levels of rigor, tones. A podcast can be anything, and that's different from a book, which demands a certain level of rigor. A publisher would never allow a book to go out with, even innocuous fact-checking errors. I say that. I mean, there are fact-checking errors in every book, but they're very minor. They slipped by, rounds and rounds and rounds, potentially years of edits. And, the voice of a book is much more formal. And that's like the medium that I feel comfortable in. Like when I have a thought about something, I like to toil over it and perfect it and back it up over years so that by the time it's published in a book and I'm reading the audiobook, like I fully stand by it. But yeah, I do a weekly podcast too, and it's an entertainment podcast. That's the thing. It's like I would not commit to a journalistically rigorous weekly podcast because that would be disappointing.
Well,
Like,
also it's
I
fucking
would.
boring. Like, I like hearing, like, I'm also like, look, we do gossip, we do like the lighthearted conspiracy theories, but you mentioned in this book here, what was it? For your episode about weddings, right? And how there was like an old wives' tale rumor about how you have the bouquet when you walk down the aisle because people would only bathe like once a
Once a
year
year in the
and like the
medieval era,
flowers.
yeah.
When I tell you, even though later in the next paragraph you talk about how that fact was incorrect and like they did bathe more often, I'm like, oh, I'm still gonna spread it. I'm like, but isn't it fun? Because like
Yes.
it's just fun and it makes you think, and I feel like there's all these words that we use, and I'm excited to talk with you about conspiracies because that's something that like I'm about to change what the whole podcast is about, or at least relabel it, because conspiracy now means dangerous, harmful, when back in the day
Right.
it meant like myth, legend, lore,
Yeah,
mermaid.
totally.
But that idea of people being like, that wedding bouquet fact is like misinformation, like dangerous, harmful, wrong, out there. Or is it just like old
It's
wives'
lore.
tale that
It's
you heard and you
folklore.
passed down? Exactly. And it's fun. So, what do you think the difference is between like myth, legend, and dangerous conspiracy?
Oh my gosh, great question. Because there's a chapter in this book that tackles the cognitive bias, the illusory truth effect. And it's really, really simple, but it just describes our proclivity to think that something is true just because we've heard it multiple times. And this is a double-edged sword because for a long time, information was not democratized like it is now. Literacy was not widespread. The only way to learn anything was to pass it down via legends, jokes, rhyming phrases, catchy stories. And repetition was like our key means of communication. So it was, again, a good enough conclusion to jump to sort of conflate fluency with a sentiment with accuracy. But information spreads very differently now. And there's an incredible amount of panic and mistrust for good reason in headlines because, or in pieces of information that are spread on podcasts and such, because sometimes the stakes are really high. Sometimes the stakes are an election result. Sometimes the stakes are, people choosing not to get vaccinated or people cutting out family members because of an ideological rift. So there is this wide spectrum of stakes now that's come with the democratization of information, both true and false. And yet we still trust fluency as accuracy because the illusory truth effect, this cognitive bias that I reference, is deep rooted. Like we learned to process information this way, but we're also on high alert for misinformation. And that tension, that clash between the way that we've always learned truths, in scare quotes, and the ways that mistruths are being spread now is causing a great deal of conflict and tension. And so I think, yeah, sometimes people will have a knee-jerk, really negative reaction to a fairly innocuous piece of folklore because sometimes folklore does tread into the arena of dangerous disinformation that can be life-ruining, culture-ruining.
Yeah, I mean, I agree a lot with what you say about, I think that conspiracies and them spreading, right, are like a symptom of a greater problem. And what that is the fact that like the news media has just kind of like fucked us. Like even, you talk in the book too about how you were a beauty editor and how like even the headlines have to be like, this cream is like flying off the shelves, like what you need to know about this cream, because everyone's so desperate for those clicks in the attention economy. And I even noticed this with like the fucking weathermen. Like, how is it that every storm is the worst storm ever. And like, we can only go through, like, I would just, it would be so palate cleansing to hear a weather guy be like, it's going to be an okay storm, but like, you'll get through it. But they never say that. It's always like,
here's the tough thing about that is that, you know, the sort of measured action items of crisis communicators and meteorologists are now having to compete in the like doomsday economy, really. It's the attention economy, but it's the doomsday economy. I just wrote an op-ed for Esquire about doomslang, or this linguistic pattern of invoking the apocalypse in casual everyday colloquialisms, like, oh, how was your weekend? I mean, other than the slow burning demise of the planet, you know, or like,
yes.
Yeah. Or like, I'm doom scrolling, I'm bed rotting, you know, a lot of language like that, or the this is fine dog meme. And I couldn't help but notice how interesting it was that, you know, the apocalypse is like so chill now, and we're, you know, invoking it in these casual everyday
conversations. Well, not only is it so chill, but if you try and act like, I did this TikTok about, remember those t-shirts, life is good, and it would be like a little stick figure on an Adirondack chair.
Yes.
I was like, if those t-shirts were around now, people would almost look at you and kind of be like, fuck you. Like, you think life is good.
Yeah.
Like, you haven't read enough. Like, you don't know what's going on. So it's almost like the apocalypse is chill now, but also if you're happy with life or yourself, people are kind of like, fuck off. Like, you don't deserve to be, which I find so bizarre.
To be doing well. Yeah. It's uncool to be doing well. Well, it also feels like politically irresponsible to admit that you're doing well, considering all the doomy horrors that we know about happening globally and next door and everywhere else. And yet, objectively, in many ways, life is better than it's ever been.
Today's episode is brought to you by Way, Way Hair Care. We all know how time-consuming it is to style your hair. For me, I actually take the time to watch 45-minute Ugly Betty episodes each time I straighten my hair because that's how long it takes. So if you want a little bit of time back in your day and to feel good about your hair, check out Way's new anti-frizz cream. It has this incredible North Bondi scent, and it also helps with heat damage, which I feel like all of us are basically using heat on our hair at this point. You can also check out some more of Way's bestsellers. They have a leave-in conditioner that also fights frizz. They have an incredible detox shampoo. I see everybody using this on TikTok. Detox shampoo, it's like the new thing. I thought that I had a, you know, messed up scalp until I started using it. And they have hair oil and that beautiful hair gloss that I've talked about before. So you can frizz-free up your schedule with Way. Go to theouai.com and enter the promo code Fluently. You'll get 15% off any product. That's theouai.com with the promo code Fluently.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that with your chapter on nostalgia. And I've always been fascinated by this, right? Like, I always do think like the early 2000s were so much better. The 90s were better. I do think that there was a period in time when we had access to the internet, but like, you logged on to AIM. The fact that you don't log online now, we've just been online for 10 years. And anytime you get a phone call, right, you either screen it or you answer it, but you have to make a decision either way. Like, I really miss the concept of logging online and chatting with other people who are online, but obviously I also like hot water and toilets. So like, you don't want to go too far back.
Yeah.
But this idea of people talking about the cottagecore aesthetic and all of these trad wives on TikTok, I find it so funny because it's like different sides of the same coin. And I remember I wrote this blog post about trad wife versus cottagecore years ago before it was on TikTok. And it's funny because cottagecore kind of came out of a group of lesbians who were like, I feel like we're doing all this for the male gaze. Like, I don't want to give in to what this is. I just want to be in a big flowy dress doing what's chill to me. And then that kind of looks aesthetically as the same thing as a trad wife. But the ideology is like, I'm going to submit to my man. I'm going to like get off my birth control. Like, I'm going to blah, blah, blah. Weird divine feminine stuff. How do you define? Because to me, it's almost like the way that conspiracy could be QAnon, but also people use the title to describe the joke of Kate Middleton getting a BBL. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And then I feel like people throw the word trad wife at a woman who is submitting to her man, but also a girl who is just cooking in her kitchen. So how do you kind of define the difference here of people in a dress cooking for somebody? And is it sinister or is it not?
I mean, I myself was very confused about the definition of trad wife. And I recently recorded an episode of Sounds Like a Cult about this very subject matter, where I interviewed Anne Helen Peterson, iconic cultural commentator and the high priestess of knowing about trad wives, and she clarified a lot for me. But yeah, I mean, I'm a cottage core girly all the way. Like, you should see my house. The number of toadstool tchotchkes I own is offensive. I mean, for me, I think my gravitation toward that had a lot to do with the pandemic, when a lot of us were reevaluating our lives and thinking about a post-apocalyptic return to the earth. And there were more than a few nefarious figures with all kinds of ideologies who wanted to step in and take advantage of our fear and our paranoia during that time. You know, the conspiratorial flavor was different depending on your particular community, your algorithm. So there were, you know, some dudes with rat tails falling down a more classic QAnon rabbit hole. And then there were, you know, girlies in their 20s whose For You page were showing them, subject verb agreement. And then there were, you know, girlies in their 20s who were feeling sad and alone and scared and interested in, you know, floral printed frocks, whose TikTok For You pages were showing them a vision of a simpler return to the earth, return to traditional values kind of life that felt manageable in a time of incredible tumult. And so I think that, you know, the really evangelical rooted trad wife community was able to lure a lot of people in that they otherwise wouldn't be able to because of the conditions of the pandemic and the incredible Laura Ingalls Wilder aesthetic. Chef's kiss.
Yeah. Well, once again, I think it's like so many things where, and one of my pet peeves is when people talk about like those people who fall down these rabbit holes or get into conspiracy theories and they're like, oh, it's just because like they're stupid or because like they're secretly evil and like they've always had these desires. Whereas I think people fall into conspiracy theories because like the media has lied to us, and people fall into trad wife and homeschooling because school was then on Zoom for a year. Like, people were paying for Harvard, but going to like Zoom classes, and your screen time's 8 hours. So they return to that. And people fall into the divine feminine dating ideology because things have kind of switched to an area where men think it's okay to be like, you up, come on over and like do this for me. So I feel like these people fall into things, you know, that's like the typical overcorrection because we're like upset with something. But I feel like instead of fixing the root cause, people are like, these conspiracy theorists are crazy. Like, the trad wives are crazy. Like, the divine feminine people are crazy, but they're not talking about the root of it. So I feel like it's never going to get fixed. And when people are shamed for something, they only skid further into it because they want to get away from the people who are shaming them. So
that is so accurate. Yeah.
So, and like, what do you think is like the cure for all of this?
Oh gosh, the cure. Oh my God. If I could monetize the cure, I would be a wealthy woman. Well, I always, when you're looking for the cure or a treatment for a disease, whether it's a more abstract disease or a physical disease, you really have to find the cause. And the cause for so much conspiratorial thinking in our society right now boils down to this cognitive bias that I write about in the book called Proportionality Bias, which explains really destructive conspiratorial mindsets, but also more positive seeming ideas of manifestation and the idea that, like, you can turn your situation into a positive from a negative with your mind alone or with these, you know, sort of new agey practices, which aren't inherently bad, but can send you down a more conspiratorial path that could have really negative consequences. So in a conspiratorial context, you know, the pandemic struck. This is this global calamity that no one can definitively explain. We jumped to the conclusion that, like, surely this was not the product of a bunch of random unfortunate events. It had to have been engineered by a government on purpose. That's the only way this quote unquote makes sense to us. Same thing with, you know, conspiracy theory like the royal family killed Princess Diana. She couldn't have just died in a car crash at random. That does not make proportional sense to us. She must have been murdered by the royal family. It must have been an inside job. We, you know, appreciate beautiful proportions as human beings, whether you're talking about like a photograph or worldwide tragedies. And so I think that has so much to do with it. This fact that I can't get over, which is that, you know, we as humans are the only species that makes up stories, that fictionalizes events in order to infuse some kind of cosmic logic into, you know, the fact that, like, human life is really chaotic and like doesn't make sense all the time. And that's okay. And we kind of just need to ride the wave.
And we're now moving into this area where, of course, like you don't want to be associated with QAnon. Those fuckers are like crazy. But it comes out, oh, there was an island with Jeffrey Epstein and he was friends with Prince Andrew. And oh, the Nickelodeon docuseries comes out and these kids were being abused and there were pedophiles on set. So all of these things are starting to come true. So how do you kind of hold both of those things in your hand when like that stuff starts to come true?
Yeah, I mean, I just really think that you can't allow figures who want to weaponize the truths that are convenient to their agenda, you can't allow them to take advantage of you. Like returning to your own sense of critical thinking and your own sense of independent thinking is consistently so important because there is a grain of truth in almost every cult, in almost every conspiracy theory. Like it stems from something. It's not just that like we're deranged and we're brainwashed, you know?
Yeah.
Like there is usually the easiest lies to believe are the ones that are closest to the truth. And conspiracy theories work by fracturing your trust in one entity and allowing that to spiral out of control. It is important to be skeptical of institutions, of headlines. Everybody has their own agenda. But be isolating yourself on this one ideological island and sort of bowing down to the rhetoric of one particular figure or one particular news outlet can be really dangerous. So yeah, it sucks and it's hard to like resist committing to one single group or ideology because we as human beings are social creatures and we are incentivized to align with a group, even if we don't like fully believe in everything that they're saying. But I think it is more important than ever during this particular time in history to resist that dogma, to resist the illusory truth effect, to resist confirmation bias, to resist all of these cognitive biases, or at least the ones that we have time to become aware of, because there are other people who are more than willing to take advantage. So that's really the crux of the matter is that
Yeah.
Like we are never going to fully embody the truth, right? And yet there are so many people who are, you know, sort of happy to come forward and say like, I have the truth, follow me.
Now, just to wrap things up here, the book talks all about, right, all of these different like cognitive distortions and these like belief systems and these biases that we fall into naturally as humans. Just to end on a positive note, throughout your research, what are some like great things that humans do or some like fun ways that we think that help each other out or really like inventive?
Oh my God, so many. I mean, this is like the magic in magical overthinking. Magical thinking all on its own can be a really beautiful thing. It's a coping mechanism. It helps us reclaim agency during times of crisis. Like I love a little bit of Delulu. It's how we get anything done. You know, speaking of overconfidence, if we didn't overvalue our ability to do things, we would never make progress. We would never make art. This podcast wouldn't exist. My book wouldn't exist. You know, like we are dreamers. And I think that's a beautiful thing. Every single one of these cognitive biases is a double-edged sword and comes with pros and cons. So there's one that I tackle in my very last chapter called the IKEA effect, which talks about our penchant to overvalue products that we helped create, which is Delulu in one capacity, but also it makes us, it's like so quaint that we want to engage in DIY activities with our friends and that like if we helped make something, we like tend to think it's so precious. Or if like someone that we love made something for us, we value it so much. Working with our hands is something that is deeply curative to the human spirit. There's a little footnote in that chapter in the book where I reference a study that talked about how knitters with depression find that their depressive tendencies are mollified by the act of knitting. There's all these like really simple but beautiful pieces of research in the book. You know, one talks about how perceiving nature, even just like looking at a beautiful view, makes people feel less materialistic. It makes time feel more expansive. There are like actually deceptively simple ways to combat the worst of these cognitive biases in a way that also connects to the biases themselves.
Yeah, I love that. I remember hearing, right, that like if you want somebody to like you, have them do a tiny favor for you. Like it was in some sort of psychology book where it's like on the first day of school, like ask someone to borrow a pencil because then your seatmate will like you more. And I always find that interesting that we like people that we end up helping, which, you would think would be the opposite version of that.
Yeah, how beautiful is that? Like, we are communal beings. We are mystical beings. We just want our lives to feel meaningful. We just want things to make sense. And that those values are becoming overcomplicated in the information age, but some of the solutions to them are oddly simple.
Yeah, I love it. Well, Amanda, thank you so much for coming on. Your book is out, I believe, April 9th. So by the time
That's
this
it.
comes out, the book will be available, The Age of Magical Overthinking: Notes on Modern Irrationality. So thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, my
And for everybody
pleasure.
else, we will see you next week for another episode of Fluently Forward. Bye, guys.